Welcome to Journeys Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week, I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. Searching for the meaning of life's experiences, your sole purpose perhaps? Well, in the book Unlocking the Invisible Child, A Journey from Heartbreak to Bliss reveals the key to self-healing of body and mind through the grace and gratitude of the heart and soul via the all-compassionate knowing invisible child within. Well, in this book, intuitive healer, counselor, and teacher Laura Mayer shares her remarkable journey. It began with the discovery of a crippling and supposedly fatal disease at age 14. She chronicles the 40-year course of the disease along with her multi-stage self-healing process and suggests that anyone can take a similar journey to heal their own life. Unlocking the Invisible Child is the amazing account of Laura Mayer's remarkable journey. She reveals to us a truth, that healing has and always been the unique journey of the soul. Mayer writes from the heart. Her courageous account will inspire and encourage anyone who wants to be more than they are at present. It's a joy to have her joining me on the program today. And she's coming to us from beautiful Arizona. Hey, Laura, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's lovely to be here.
You've got a powerful story to tell. I can't imagine at age 14 being told you have a crippling disease and that you might not even survive.
Yeah.
What was
That's
that?
That's exactly what I was told.
What was that like when you heard that news? I mean, how, at such a young age, how did you handle that?
I'm really not sure. How's that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's about as truthful as I can say. I think I just took it in.
Yeah.
And sort of did my life. I don't remember. I mean, I was scared, but I really didn't have the ability to be scared, I guess. I don't know. I just did life.
Yeah.
It wasn't something we talked about in my family home, believe it or not.
So
it wasn't focused on. I sort of just did life.
Now,
and I think that's actually what propelled me forward.
How healthy were you up until that time?
I was extremely healthy. I mean,
yeah.
I never got sick. I was into. I wasn't an athlete, quote unquote, but I was on the diving team, the swim team. I played guitar. I mean, I took private art lessons. I was totally using my hands, my body. Everything got disrupted. I wrote in my book how the only thing they couldn't take away, the disease couldn't take away, was my dancing.
Yeah.
My partner would have to hold my hand so tight so I wouldn't slip out. But it was out of the blue at 14, and then 15, it was when I got slammed with that trajectory.
Yeah. How rare is anterior horn cell disease?
It's rare.
Yeah, because I had not heard of it.
It's part of the anterior horn cell diseases.
Yeah.
So it's in the same league as ALS and polio.
Oh, wow.
And because it was bilateral, both sides of my body, they named it anterior horn cell. And, you know, back then we didn't know what we know now about ALS. I know polio was pretty strong. I had a couple of friends who had that through my career. But
yeah.
I mean, my parents were terrified, I think, but they never shared that with me or talked to me about it. We didn't know. It was sort of, the dictum was you will lose a millimeter a month of muscle strength.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. So much of your healing, which we'll get into here later in our conversation, is about love, the healing power of love, really. And
absolutely.
In this memoir, in this early part of the book, you talk about, I suppose he was your first love, Michael? Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was a very strong love because I didn't really know love from my parents, is what I mean. He really, he was more than just a boyfriend.
Did your parents withhold affirmation, hugs? I mean, how did they not show love for you?
All of that. I never heard it. I mean, once at 16, I heard it from my father. My mother was very distant from me. My father was a good man. He was the responsible one. He was the doctor. But there was there wasn't much showing of love.
Yeah.
I mean, he did it more than my mother. And, you know, as a kid, I needed that. I was grateful that I had a boyfriend and I had friends. I was in a popular group, you know, all that nonsense, really, in retrospect.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of loss to what I could do. I could never play gym. I could never engage with my friends in tennis or skiing or anything like that. So.
Yeah, you described this as physically, this meant I was locked inside a body, slowly collapsing inward, losing muscle mass in my arms and pulling the tendons of my hands in the shape of claws. A terrible diagnosis for anybody, let alone, I think, a young girl who also was so active in sports. That's like your life.
That and having somebody to love me. So this boy, Michael, who was very bright, wanted to be an architect. I mean, he came from a really lovely place, was really what I clung to.
Yeah.
And I say that because in retrospect, it makes sense, you know, why that was so important. When we broke up, I realized I needed to take care of me.
Yeah.
And that's when I really applied myself in school and, you know, did really well academically after that. And became an occupational therapist.
Where,
very well.
Where did that strength and courage come from? Most people wouldn't have done that with that kind of diagnosis, with the kind of pain that you were living with, to apply yourself to the degree that you were able to do all that.
Honestly, Richard, I don't know. And in I don't know where it came from. I spoke about it in my book, and when I think about it now, I mean, even when you're reading from the book, the passages, I want to cry. It's hard for me to believe that was me. I think I just knew I had to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it wasn't thriving. It wasn't, I was going to be this person. I just have to figure out how to survive it. I look back a lot. And I think I was guided in a way, spiritually, emotionally, energetically, because I always landed in the right places. that didn't come from my personality. I was scared. I was lonely. But I just never gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And, Richard, honestly, I love the fact that I can sit here and say, I don't really know. Because that allows the freedom to go in and understand how these other powers are there way before you make a connection to it. And that feels very allowing and loving to me. And somehow I did that. I mean, I could have gotten married at 20 years old. I could have had this wonderful doctor take care of me the rest of my life. I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something in me had to keep going forward.
Yeah.
But I have no idea why I really don't. I didn't then, let's put it that way. Now I do. I didn't then, which is amazing, isn't it? Because we all have that within us.
There's a line in your book early on that I highlighted because of what you just talked about. And it might be difficult for some people who are imagining themselves in a similar situation, but you said, the disease gave me the courage to survive. Mm-hmm. It gave you the courage to survive. The disease did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that thing that you really can't fully explain. There was just something inside you.
When I hear that or I read that in my own book when I'm doing, speaking about the book, what comes through is I was a needy kid. I just wanted someone to love me. I was a loving little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And if the disease didn't happen, God knows what would have happened to me, okay? Mm-hmm. I could see me, you know, I used to say, you know, I want to run off to a commune, right? I had Groovy and Peace and all this written in my, you know, playroom basement, you know, walls. I just wanted that. I wanted community. I wanted to be part of a whole. So when I say that and look back on that, there was a lot of grace in having this disease for me, and I hope this makes sense to the people who are listening and to you. It redirected my energy to I better be able to do this. I need to focus on a career. I'm going to do this no matter what, rather than allow myself to run off to some community team, you know, which I wasn't in a family that would allow that, but, you know, who knows? You know, by 18, I was already having major difficulty with my hands.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating in looking back. I know that sounds interesting.
Well, no, you know, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who passed away, Lauren Powell. Many people in the Midwest would know her as she was a sound healer. And long story short, she had battled various forms of cancer for about 10 years. And just last year, finally realized, I think it's got me. And she decided to go for a quality of life and no more radiation or chemo. And she actually spoke for us at one of our Walk the Talk speaker series. And her title was Dancing Deliciously with Death. There was something inside her that caused her to also have that courage in spite of an outcome that she knew would happen. And I still remember the text I got. Her sister texted me. They were down in Bloomington, Indiana, when she took her last breath. And her sister texted and said, Lauren's moved on, and I want you to know she died dancing deliciously with death. So there are sometimes things, that inner strength that I think the human spirit can have, you certainly did and still do, that that really assisted you and actually helped you achieve, because that had to be cool at, I don't know what age, 20 or something, or maybe even younger, when you got an acceptance letter to New York University. That's a tough university to get into.
Well, I will share that that wasn't the I went to Jersey State College the first 2 years for special ed, and I you read the book. So, and what was really profound was that we had to do volunteer work, because I wanted to be a nurse. I always wanted to be a nurse and an area doctor. That was my MO. I had a doctor. I had a doctor killed there instead of a Ken doll for my Barbie. Okay. So I, you know, there was a part of me that came in as this Florence Nightingale. I knew I was a healer of some sort, you know, way back then. But what was beautiful was there's a 200-classroom building across the street from the college where we had to volunteer special ed. And they put me, in the occupational therapy department. 200 classrooms, and they put me in the occupational therapy department. Now, I always wanted to work in a hospital. It just was my thing. And, wow. And within 2 weeks of volunteering, my supervisor said, you have to be an OT. You're amazing. You'll be great. And I applied. And Tony, who was the man who interviewed me, said to me, well, tell me about your hands. Now, I already got warned from my father not to tell anybody about my hands, okay? Like, how do you do that? They're external. You can see it. Like, really? Come on. And what he said to me was an angel's comment. It was incredible. He said, you can make this an asset or a liability. Yeah. It's your choice.
Yeah.
And I took that. I'm chilling as I say that. That was one of the greatest lines I heard at that age. I mean, I was 20 years old. I got in, and, you know, I spent 2 years there. I went on to graduate school there, and I worked as an occupational therapist, was a department chief. I mean, the whole nine yards. I did beautifully, even with my surgeries and with my hands. That's the power of your heart.
Yeah, I found it so interesting that you decided to become a licensed occupational therapist, even with the limitation of your hands.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was perfect because it talks to independence. It talks to functioning. It talks to compensating.
Yeah.
And I was the mirror of that. So I actually did very well and had a lot of respect with both staff and patients. I was a walking OT, no differently than what I do now. There's a inside-out spirit that really propels me forward, I want to say. Mm. Yeah, I did it. I did it for years. I worked at major medical centers, and then I worked with children in the classroom. But then my hand surgeon, after 15 surgeries, said, you have to stop working. You won't have hands at 50.
Yeah.
So that was the end of my career. I mean, it was painful. It was very, very painful to work, and I had zero muscle strength in my hands.
Were you age 43 when your hand surgeon said you had to stop working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had two children. I had a house to run. It wasn't, you know, I had things to do.
Well, he not only said you have to stop working, but he said something that nobody wants a doctor to say, and that is there's nothing left we can do.
Right. And this is a man that I've known for 40 years. So I met him, you know, when I was 26, when my left hand became paralyzed. Mm-hmm. I was working at Tufts Medical Center. He was the, you know, he was the chief hand surgeon at Tufts. Mm-hmm. So it was just a beautiful coincidence, like really, that I met him. And he said to me, it's not a hand problem, it's in your spine, but I'm going to do everything I can to help you function.
You had also gone through a divorce too, didn't you?
Not at that point.
Okay.
I had gone through a divorce years after that.
Okay, okay.
So yeah, there are a lot of angels that came in.
So what did you do after that when he told you that you needed to leave your career? You're 43. Because if I remember right, a whole door opened for you in terms of spirituality, didn't it?
It did. But before that, I mean, I was, what do I do? What do I do with my life? Mm-hmm. I mean, I had two children. I had a husband. I had a beautiful home in New York.
Yeah.
And what do I do with my life? I mean, OT kept me in a place that I knew. Mm. I could function. I could do great. I was applauded for my skills and expertise. And all of a sudden, that was going to be dropped. Mm. It was heartbreaking. I don't want to say I was suicidal, but I was. You know, I remember skiing down the mountain saying I could just ski off, but I could not leave my children. So I would not do that. But I was in a very sad place because all of a sudden, after all this, wow, you know, keep on going. I knew I had to stop. I mean, I was in agony. I couldn't hold my pen for 3 minutes without my shoulder and neck hurting me. I mean, it was painful. It wasn't just stressful. It was painful.
Yeah,
And my body was really saying, we need a break, kiddo. We need a break. So that's when I actually started reading.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of spirituality, about spirituality, Kabbalistic work, really feeding the heart and soul of me. I felt like I was getting another master's in, like, you know, spiritual, religious kind of stuff, you know, Buddha, you name it, I was reading it. And that fed me a lot.
Yeah.
It was an interesting 5 years.
You got very involved with the Jewish Renewal at a Retreat and Healing Center. Accord,
yes,
New York? Yeah, tell me more about that.
So I actually was reading a book on Kabbalistic work, and they mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
So I called up my friend, and I said, let's go. And, I wasn't religious at all. I really wasn't brought up Jewish in any way. My parents rebelled, but it was such a loving, heart-centered place. And the whole Judaic kind of presence was really based on the soul and based on what's called kishkes in the Jewish religion. It's the heart. Mm-hmm. It's all from your heart. So there's dancing. There's like, it's not just dogma. It was a uplifting, wonderful place to be. And I got very involved in silent meditation retreats.
Yeah.
Where I learned how to go in. And the discovery, which was profound at that point, was one day somebody was speaking about Jacob's ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just the whole story of Jacob that transformed himself and became Israel, right? He went from being ill to being healthy.
Yes.
Wellness. And that was the first, like, wow, this disease is in my spine. That's my ladder. What am I to learn? So there was a door opening. Yeah, there was a door opening right there. Like, I know if it's in my spine. I had an amazing teacher, Rabbi David Cooper, who was really became a friend. He, you know, we taught each other. I mean, you know, I'm brazen enough to have that level. And it was wonderful, wonderful teaching and learning and understanding and accepting of who I was with my hands that were pretty dysfunctional. And, yeah, very, very wonderful time of going in. When you're silent, you can only go in, right? you know, you got to stop talking, which is wonderful for me, and to really go in and see what's going on. And it was powerful. I was involved with them for about 10 years.
Was that, during that time, was that the first time you were starting to do week-long meditation retreats?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and then I ended up volunteering there, so I, you know, was putting books away in the bookstore just to get the energy. I learned about energy, and I got to witness many, many other people and experiences. So it was an opening for something other than the medical world, which is what I was ensconced in. For 50 years, it was my life.
You were, and that's when you were also exploring with visualizing. Your fingers being perfectly straight, and you would do that every morning.
Well, so, you know, I was chanting and all this, but then I stepped into sort of this, this whole thing led, the whole spiritual piece, the Kabbalistic piece and meditation led me just magically, like breadcrumbs. My whole life has been breadcrumbs. That's how I look at it. And I just keep following the breadcrumbs. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that I met somebody at this place who did Jinshin Jitsu, and, you know, had some sessions with him, and he said, you have to meet this woman. And so I had a three-hour healing session on the phone, because we didn't do Skype back then. She was a PhD clinical psychologist from NYU, thank God, because I knew nothing, you know, metaphysical world, and a shaman and a medical intuitive. And she read me completely. And she said, after 3 hours, you'll completely heal. You're a master teacher, master healer. And in my naivete, I said, no, I'm not. I'm an occupational therapist. Get in bed. Your adrenal glands are shot. And I did. I hung up with her. And I said, I'm done. Either I heal or I'm out of here. And that is when I took it into my own hands. And I would look at my hands and I would stretch them out because they were clawed, literally. And I would say, if I don't love you, hands, how can you love me back? And, oh, my God, it was just, it was a whole other way of looking at it because I was embarrassed. I felt like damaged merchandise for years, for 52 years. And when I dropped that and started loving myself, which is why that's the first line in my book, oh, my gosh, I watched my physicality respond to my emotionality, and that was the key. Mm-hmm. When my heart healed, I opened the doorway for other healing to happen, if it's meant to in this lifetime. That's how I view it.
Yeah. Yeah, you said, I went into all this healing saying, I just want my hands to be perfect. I just want to be able to hold my glass like everybody else and not struggle. But I found myself shifting to where it didn't even matter what my hand function was doing. It really mattered how my heart held me. That's beautiful.
I'm crying.
What did that?
So lovely to hear it back.
What is that like for you?
That's when I realized it's not about my physicality. Mm-hmm. It's about my heart that was so wounded and alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even new, because, you know, in the book I share at 9 years old, I literally put out, of course it wasn't the universe at that point. I didn't even know about God at that point. Yeah. But I literally put it out to whatever, that I want to be in the hospital. And if I'm in the hospital, somebody will love me. And maybe the Beatles will come and visit me. There was such a desperation to be loved that I realized I actually allowed myself to understand that Laura, the personality, wanted this disease. I know we would never do that to ourselves, but on a soul level, something had to wake me up this lifetime to get a handle, no pun intended there, on the sadness that permeated me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized it wasn't my hands, and it's not just about holding my pen or holding this or holding that. It's about how I held my heart and how I loved myself. And everything changed because of that.
Mm.
And I never felt damaged anymore. It doesn't matter what I can't do.
Yeah.
I never feel damaged.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
Yeah, you said when I started focusing and unlocking my inner child dramas and traumas that I still held, that allowed me to open up, release,
mm-hmm.
and heal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In every way. Open up my hands. Open up my heart. I didn't even know that the hands and heart were in the same chakra. I had no idea. I think some of my, when I look back, I love the fact that I was so naive because I wasn't taking this information out of a book. I didn't know any of this, and
yeah.
I learned it. I sort of grew into this on my own.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing that your hands and your heart are in the same chakra. So when my heart opened, my hands opened. How's that? Amazing, huh?
You know, what I always still find fascinating is you also said it helped me to recognize how damage done is early on. It's really about having the courage to love yourself enough. With all the guests I've had on in 17 years, 17 and a half years of doing this show, authors on books and things, and I'll talk to them either in the interview or after we're done. We'll talk a little bit before we hang up the phone. And one of the questions I often will ask is, given all these needs, given all these, you know, how-tos, whatever, what is the greatest need that we have? And almost everybody said the need to love ourselves.
Yeah.
With all the books out there, with all the DVDs, with all the information out there, we still beat ourselves up too much, or we're still holding on to those, I guess, inner demons in a sense, and not knowing what
mm-hmm.
to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually is a beautiful segue, if you're ready for it,
yeah.
to the work I do today, because we don't even know. Most of us aren't aware
yeah.
of what we're holding in our energetics.
Yeah, yeah.
What we bring forward. And until we get in there, I mean, this is not superficial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
is what's riding you. What's in there? That's so difficult. All the books, all the one-on-one, you know, conferences that we go to, all of this isn't going to shift that. This is major cellular work
mm-hmm.
that has to be shifted in order for the expression of who we are to be shifted. And so, you know, I'm a deep person. I've always been a deep person. I mean, I have a disease in the spine, you know, like, give me a break. I mean, even my disease was deep. I mean, there's everything about me was deep this lifetime. And so I loved doing that deep esoteric work.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped me to not accept, you know, 101 or, you know, how many books can you read? You read 50 books. It's okay. You're done reading. It's now it's time to do the work. Actually step
yes.
up and do
yes,
the work,
because
we can keep reading until we're 100, but
absolutely.
It's not going to change us.
Yes.
We have to say, put down the books, open up your heart, and really go into what the causes are, what the deep holdings are within you
mm-hmm.
that's so hard, the patterns, the behaviors that are so hard to break,
mm-hmm.
because they're in there,
mm-hmm.
and they're based on trauma, and maybe not just yours, but the trauma from previous lives, not lives, your own life, but other, you know, your families, the generations before you.
Yeah.
And that to me has been the greatest discovery. This isn't mine to hold. This is yours. And I get to change that.
And what?
I didn't know that the first 10 years. So this is really kind of like added wonderness to the whole process.
What do you do to maintenance the healing that you've experienced to maintain as best as you can to be in that healthier place? Are there certain practices you do or what?
That is such a wonderful question. Thank you for that question, Richard. I love that question because this is what I do. Absolutely everything and nothing. I recognized a long time ago that had a great conversation with my the Rebbe who taught me the meditation, right? It's not about sitting on the cushion. and we agreed. Everything I do, I make into a meditation. I'm chopping vegetables, I'm whatever. What am I doing? What am I doing every day of my life that is telling every cell in my body, I love you. I love you. And so it's, I never said that before. I do everything and nothing. I don't have a quote unquote practice. I walk every day. I'm always in the deep thought. I have fun. I lightened up so that I have a wonderful witness sense of humor, which makes life so much easier. And I recognize that, that you could be deep and heavy, or you can be deep and light. So, you know, I tease that I'm the Dr. Seuss of spirituality because I'm always rhyming. It's really kind of funny. But I realize I am. I mean, there's always a rhyme. My clients are like, write this down, write this down. And I realized it was the universe's way of saying to me, Richard, lighten up, girl. It's okay. You're doing great. And I had to lighten up in order to look at this. So what do? I'm incredibly conscious and aware of everything I do. I see life as an opportunity. And, you know, I'll tell people at workshops or wherever I am, you know, look, I had 40 years of a disease, 18 surgeries, and a mother who says, who's going to want you? If I feel amazing, anyone can. We just have to make up our mind. Now, I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm a freaking New Yorker, and there's no Pollyannas who grew up in New York. But I have a positive, I'm going to do this because I want this attitude. And that's what I bring for me. That's what I bring to others. I didn't say it's easy. Nothing in life is easy, but you have choices. And the choice I make is to stay positive. Recently, to answer your question very directly, it became very clear to me that we all have a barometer for our stress level. Now, when I wrote the book, I said, wow, I transformed the disease. And I was really in a very different place than I am now. And that was 2012 that I published that book. And it's not that I am not incredibly excited of the healing I have conquered in this lifetime. It's amazing. It really is. And I appreciate, and that's why I loved your question, at any moment, I can turn that around and my hands could be absolutely disabled. And it's the stress. I just got chills on this. It's the stress that I am monitoring through my happy heart. So when I am engaged in someone who's really angry or nasty or this or that, I will not take it in. It will destroy me. So I'm very conscious, and I have a barometer. We all do. What is our barometer so that we can see how our stress actually, you know, I'm talking deep soul, you know, stress, cellular stress. We get to monitor that and be the, you know, be the one who corrects it or changes it. So that's actually what I do. If I had any method to keeping me who I am, it's being that level of awareness and monitoring. When, you know, I don't want to be around people that are angry, attacking. I mean, as clients, yes, I will help them, but I choose to be around people that have a positive attitude.
Is there a common thread in what people who come to you to help do their deep work? Is there a common thread in their presenting concerns or symptoms that you see?
So, not surprising, right? Because like attracts like. I have a lot of people who have tried everything, read every book, gone to everybody, and said, okay, it's not working. I need you. You know, done surgeries, done this, you know, overeaters that have the stomach surgery and they gain the weight back. Like, yes. If we don't change the soul level of who we are, if we don't change how we view ourselves, it's all about attitude, then it's going to not change, period. And so I get a lot of people like that, people who really have made a commitment to change. I know this is against all business models, but it's there's not one population or another, male, female, 18, 90, doesn't matter. What my desire is, because it is a lot of attention. Let's put it that way. I don't use the word work. It's a lot of attention. It's a lot of awareness to be on for a while. Okay? Eventually, it just becomes part of your makeup. But what's really critical is somebody's willingness to change. Okay? I mean, you have to really want to change. And, you know, have, I make a commitment to that. That's to have the courage and commitment to be change, because you can. I really believe that. Now, again, I never say to somebody, you'll change your physicality. I mean, I've worked with ALS clients. I work with people who are stuck in marriages. It doesn't, it's not just the physicality. Everything comes out for some, you know, everybody gets something somehow. So, you know, the woman who's stuck in a marriage, her back hurts all the time, or this or that. So I do, I always, because I do have that medical intuitive edge, is make direct connections to body and emotion.
Okay.
Of course. Look at me.
Yes. Well, but you've always said and often said that if your heart heals, your body will heal, that healing is really based in the heart, not the mind, which is interesting because a lot of people might think just the opposite.
Well, if you can convince yourself to change, you can't. You can't convince yourself in your personality. It's really of opening, you know, like arms wide open and allowing the change to happen organically because of your positive attitude, who you are, and what you believe in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an attitude.
Where does I'm wondering where does non-duality fit into this?
I love that. One of my first teachers spoke to non-duality all the time, Jason Shulman. I think we live in a dualistic world. When we get to a place where there's no duality because we hold all sides equally, and there's a peacefulness about that. That to me is how I see non-duality. There's a, you hold that space. I don't want to use the word higher self. I think that's overdone. But you hold that soulful piece of you, the personality piece of you. You're not arguing with one another. You're just resting in that place and being you, truthfully you. Then you get, you know, you hold it all. And so it's not this or that. It's, it just is.
I remember going something through something in 2016 when, after a period of 3 years or so of intense stress with work and various things I was involved with and probably drinking too much coffee and not enough water, I mean, all kinds of things, I had a doctor actually tell me he thought I had lupus and I had other symptoms. Long story short, through the help of a few friends and actually by listening to non-duality teachers on YouTube, I just started practicing presence. I would, in the middle of the night when you wake up, like some people do, and we all have our shadows, and for it's all different for everyone, so maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's fear. The only this time what I would do is recognize that it's coming up to be held, not healed. So I would hold it. I would literally take, like I'm doing now in the studio, taking my hands, like I'm holding fear, like little Ricky, who had that fear because of the inner child. And I found that through repetition and practicing presence as much as I could, noticing things more, much like what you were just talking about too, that in a matter of time, there was no timeline, but one particular day, and for me it was about a year or so, it just lifted.
Absolutely.
It just lifted. So I hear you. I hear exactly what you're talking about. And but to go through what you've gone through and the 18 surgeries and such, and that's dramatic improvement. But it's so fascinating to me that it is based in the heart, not the mind. It is about love. How about that? Sages have been talking about this for thousands of years.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's where going back and reading. I mean, I was reading, you know, 12th century works. It's all that.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, being in joy in your heart, in your gut, in your belly. It's the joy is what keeps you going forward. what you just said is exactly why I responded to what do I do every day. Mm-hmm. I don't sit on a cushion, and I'm not judging that. I personally don't sit on a cushion or do that.
Yeah.
Because I am in that mindful state. When I first decided to do meditation retreats, you know, David Cooper pulled me back into an office and said, "You're aware of everything. You didn't have a choice."
Mm.
And it wasn't that I'm this whatever, you know, mindful person.
Yeah.
I had to be a mindful person. Every door I opened, every shirt I bought, everything I ate, I had to think about how am I going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew into this incredibly mindful person. When I stopped being scared of that level of mindfulness because it was bothersome, because it's my hands and my, you know, paralysis I'm being mindful about, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just loved me.
Yeah.
It shifted. So, yes, I do believe, and it's been the last 8-10 months of my life, is to really find where these deep hidden, I want to call them secrets. It's funny, I keep hearing the word secrets, but these hidden, I'm going to use that word then, these hidden secrets that lay within ourselves that we're not even aware of. So, you know, it's amazing in a heartbeat how you can turn that around once you become aware of it.
Yeah.
And it goes back to, you know, utero. It goes back to patterns and beliefs that we carry from others. And when it's resolved, it's not a question of, oh, my gosh, you did this to me. How could you do this to me? But the resolution, because you're not in a place anymore, you're of attacking, you're in a place of understanding and appreciating.
Yes.
So there's a sense of, wow, I understand why you had this life now and why I received this part of you, that part of you, whatever.
Yes.
And there's such a letting go in that level of, oh, appreciation for where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to hold the anger anymore. Mm-hmm. So you get an opportunity to say, wow, this is yours. I'm so sorry you had to go through that. But guess what? I don't want to hold it anymore. It's hurting me. And then what you do magically, because this is what happens, is you then don't pass that on to your children.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of anything greater than that. Is to be in this place of resolution, okay?
Yeah.
And there's no place for anger or for all of that, or even there's no forgiveness anymore. You just get it. You get it with appreciation rather than, you know, I forgive you for doing all of this stuff to me.
Yes.
Listen, nobody does anything to anyone unless they're hurt themselves.
That's true.
Only a wounded person wounds another, period.
Yes.
And so when we figure out where that woundedness is sourced from, it's our letting go. And to me, it just makes me cry and smile at the ability, the privilege that we all have to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my gosh, nobody told us in school we can do that.
It does help. Well, it does help when you have somebody who can hold space for you and act as more of a guide, such as you do in your personal practice. I'm guessing, though, you would probably consider your guru is life. It's not one particular person
well,
you're following.
I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. You know, I often think I never really had a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah, energy is my hero. That is really beautiful. Listen, my desire, okay, is to inspire, is to be in the presence of others, whether it's my clinical, you know, whether it's my practice or how I speak to anyone, all right? I mean, you know me now, this is how I talk all the time, because I feel in awe at the I don't want to say magic, but the potential of what we have.
Yeah.
How could I not want to hold that space for others? You bet I want to hold that space for others. And you're doing the work. It's why I call myself a healing activator. I'm not doing your healing. You're doing your healing. But I'm intuitive enough, really deeply intuitive, that I will shift that space around so everything comes through for you so you can say, oh, my gosh, that makes sense.
Yes.
And then what you do with that sense is what you do with that sense. I mean, I guide you, I stay with you and do that. But you know what I'm saying? It's what a gift we have. What a gift. And I can't get over that. I'm always will be in awe at the gift that we have to transform our lives. Mm. And I know that firsthand, no pun intended.
Talk about...
Can't miss these words.
talk about the work that you offer. Those who are listening might want to visit you online and also set up some appointments. I know you do workshops. You do individual sessions, correct?
Yes, I do. I see clients online around the world.
Okay.
And, you know, people who live in my area that come to the door. But the work that I am doing, and I'm literally just... finding a publisher for my newest book, which is called Why Do I Feel This Way?
Great title. And it is because
I think everybody can relate to that. You don't have to be spiritual. You don't have to be medical. You don't have to be anything. You just, everybody says that to them. Why do I feel this way? Why does my back hurt? Why am I so sad? Why does my mother hate me? Whatever it is. Why? I just want to know why. Okay, so for the thinker, I want to know why. Mm-hmm. And in my discoveries the last year, it's really about this energetic inheritance. So the book is about holding the energetic inheritance, finding out the source. Because once we find out, okay, we get our answers. We get answers. And those answers will propel us forward to what is called epigenetics, to change the way our DNA expresses. So when I became positive and started loving up my hands instead of feeling like damaged merchandise and hiding them literally,
yeah.
I wouldn't eat at certain restaurants if I didn't feel comfortable with the person I was with. I mean, really?
Mm-hmm.
Not hiding it, being positive, literally changed the expression of my DNA so my fingers are working 80% better than they've ever worked in my life. Mm-hmm. That! Because of the consistency and my attitude. And we can all do that. We can all do that. So that's the work I do, is really go in there to find out what the core issues are mm-hmm. that you're holding on to, your parents held on to. We put it together. We find the magic of that. And then you get to release it. And it never fails. I swear it's fail-proof. It's amazing to me. I mean, I'm blown away all the time at my clients' responses, as I was with my own.
Yeah.
So it works. I mean, there's proof that it works. And again, it's like, why wouldn't you want this?
Well, share your web address, please.
Yeah, it's a long one. You can look me up under my name. It's probably easier, Laura Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. It's Doorway to an Audacious Life.
Yeah.
.com.
I like that word, audacious.
Yeah.
Pretty much says
well,
it all.
Well, you got to have a little audacity to be a spitfire like this and get it going.
Absolutely. Well, it's been such a joy to have the Dr. Seuss of Spirituality join me on this week's program. The book is Unlocking the Invisible Child, A Journey from Heartbreak to Bliss. I highly recommend it. I can't wait for your newest book to come out. My guest is Laura Mayer. And Laura, it's been such a joy. Thank you for not only sharing your time with me, but continuing to share your light in this world.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to share and to have somebody wonderful to speak with like you. Thank you, Richard. Really appreciate it.
Again, it was such a joy to have Laura join me on today's program. I highly recommend this book, the title, Unlocking the Invisible Child, A Journey from Heartbreak to Bliss. And you can visit her online at Doorway to an Audacious Life. That is today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me. And I also want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.